This afternoon, Ajahn Brahm will take us to the next part of our journey, which is transforming the heart. So Ajahn, pass over to you.
Okay, transforming the heart. There's a question in the box here, but I'll answer it at the very end. Transforming the heart. In Buddhism, the word for the heart actually is called jitta. It's like the same as the mind. And it's actually how we transform the what's going on inside of us. Because this is one of the other problems of actually transforming our actions. Because our actions, they come from inside of our heart. And if our heart isn't pure, it's so difficult to get pure actions out of an impure heart. In fact, it's impossible. So that's why that if we have right thought and right intention, the first two factors of the Eightfold Path, if inside of ourselves is pure, then usually what comes out is pure. And if what's inside of you is impure, then what comes out is usually impure. And it's one of these old stories which I've told. I don't think I've told this for a long time now. This was the story of the monk who actually joined, not a Buddhist monastery, a Christian monastery. And some of these Christian monasteries are so strict. And in this particular monastery, it was so strict that they had to keep noble silence for 7 years. They weren't allowed even to say one word at all. But after 7 years, you could go and see the abbot. And just, you're only allowed one sentence. The idea was that when you went into the abbot's room, you can actually give him some idea of how you were doing, to say something profound, something very, very wise, to give him an understanding of your state of spiritual progress. So this young man, he'd been in the monastery 6 years, 11 months, and 30 days. Tomorrow would be the first time he'd spoken in over 7 years. So you can imagine how excited he was. He hardly slept all night. And he started thinking about some really impressive sentence to tell his abbot. Something which would actually tell him how he was really feeling inside. And the good work he'd been doing in the monastery, and his wisdom and compassion and all those things. He needed one sentence to try and put it all together. For example, if after this one-day seminar, if I asked you to write down one sentence to see how much you got out of this seminar, what would you be able to do? And that's what it was like for him, but he couldn't write it down, he had to say it. So he worked out this, he worked out that, and just early in the morning, just before the interview, he had something really deep, really profound to say. But when he went into the abbot's office, his mind went blank. He forgot what he prepared to say, and he had to say something pretty quickly. So what actually came out of his mouth was, "The food here is terrible." It just came out like that. And the abbot, who was allowed to speak, said, "Very good, come back in another 7 years." Oh, he felt so terrible. He had his one chance, and he'd blown it. He'd said what he hadn't planned to say. So he had to go back. I was so depressed after that. But the years went past, and it came to the time he'd been in that monastery 13 years, 11 months, and 30 days. Now he'd have the second chance of saying something profound. This time he was actually more stable as a monk, more relaxed. So he had a good night's sleep. And when he woke up in the morning, he did actually have something very, very meaningful to say. But when he went into the abbot's office, it happened again. His mind went blank. He forgot what he was going to say. And the abbot said, "Come on, what are you going to say? Come on, quick, otherwise get out of here." And so he said, "You make us monks work too hard." "Very good, come back another 7 years." Oh, he'd blown it again. He'd messed up again. He made a mistake, so his mind went blank and it just came out. So now he had his third chance, because he'd been in the monastery now 21 years. And he'd only said two things, and he got it wrong both times. But this time, not only did he have a good sleep, he was also relaxed. And when he went into the abbot's office, he actually said what he meant to say, what he was planning to say. When the abbot asked, well, what's your sentence? He said, this is the sentence. He couldn't actually give an introduction at all. He said, I can't stand this place any longer. I'm leaving. And the abbot replied, it's a very good job because you've done nothing but complain ever since you came here. And that's an old joke, an old story, but it's very meaningful because the reason why he said those things, the food is terrible, or you make us work too hard, was because that's what he'd been thinking about all the time. His mind wasn't pure, he was a complaining mind, so when actually he had the opportunity to say something, he didn't say what he meant to say, he said what he was thinking all along. And this is our trouble sometimes. We want to be kind and good in our speech and our actions. We can't force it if it's not natural, if we don't really think like that, if that's not what we've been thinking about in the privacy of our minds all day. It's not going to come out. It's what we're thinking. That's what comes out. So the abbot was right. That monk had done nothing but complain silently. Every time he was having the meal, the food here is terrible. Every time that they were working, you make us work too hard. He'd been complaining inside. He'd been thinking complaints. That's why when it spoke it, it came out complaints. Now this is why the Buddha said we have to purify our mind if we're going to have pure speech and pure actions. At first it's true that our actions, we do good, as you were saying earlier, because it's just actions and speech. But afterwards when we be good, it's coming from the right place. We're purifying our mind. And the whole job of purifying your mind is a practice of meditation. Now the practice of meditation to purify your mind, you've got to know what you're talking about by the mind first of all. Many people talk about the mind, but they haven't got a clue what that thing is, because they haven't spent time looking at your mind. Now to be able to see your mind is not an easy thing to see. You do need to be still, as well as mindful. This is an old question which people ask in Buddhist meditation. How much stillness do you need? How much samadhi do you need? And how much insight do you need? How much vision do you need? And the answer to that question comes in a story, an anecdote from my life. Because when we went to our monastery in Serpentine, which is about 60 kilometers south of Perth, it's built on top of a hill. And as I said to you before, the reason why we built our monastery on top of a hill is because holy people are always supposed to be living on top of hills. I always used to say, you never hear of holy people living in swamps. But someone actually pointed out to me, there's a movie called Star Wars, and there's some character called, I think it's Yoda, who actually lives in a swamp. He's unconventional, that's all I can say. Because most holy people live on top of mountains or hills. So our monastery is on top of a hill. It's quite a steep hill. The road which goes up to that hill is about just over 2 kilometers long. Now the point of this story is that for maybe over 10 years, I'd always be taken in a car up and down that hill. And after 10 years, I really thought I knew my monastery and its surroundings. I really thought I knew that hillside. But it happened one day, it was a nice day, not too hot, not too cold, it was a sunny day, I had some time. And I thought I needed the exercise. So I asked the driver, let me down at the bottom of the hill, I'm going to walk up for a change. It's only 2 kilometers, it's not really that far, even though it's a steep hill. So I started walking up that hill. And as I started walking up, it was a very, very strange experience. Because as I looked around at the scenery, it was unrecognizable. It was like seeing that hillside for the very first time in my life. I saw things I'd never noticed before, and that hillside looked so beautiful, much more beautiful than I'd ever thought. And it was such a strange experience to me that I was wondering, what's going on? Why is it that I've been going up and down that hill for 10 years and now I'm seeing this hillside for the first time? So I stopped I stopped and gazed. And as I stopped still and started gazing at that hillside, it changed again. I started seeing things which I never knew were there. And the whole hillside became so much more beautiful and much richer in detail. And it was such a strange experience for me that I thought about that for many days, and I soon understood why these things were happening. It was basic science, basic anatomy. If you really contemplate it, if you are in a car and looking out of the window, your senses just don't have time to register all the details. Think of like the sight of the light hits the back of the eye. If you're going in a car, the scenery changes so quickly that actually the light doesn't have a chance to really establish itself on the retina and to actually to the mind for you to know what you're doing before you have to go on to the next object. When you're looking through a speeding car, things change so quickly, your senses just do not have time to fully register what's going on. All you see is shadows of reality. The colors aren't rich, the details are all blurred over. It's not a true picture of what's happening. It's the same when people speak too fast. Sometimes the last word which is said, you haven't really understood that yet, and you have to go and think of the next word. Things go so fast, you never truly understand them. So when I was going slower, walking, rather than going up at 80, 90 kilometers an hour, when I was only walking up that hillside, my eyes, my ears, even my mind had more time. What I saw, it had time to actually establish itself on the retina and the back of the eyeball, and my mind had more time to see it, to know what was going on. It didn't have to rush so fast onto the next thing, so it could appreciate and know fully what was happening. That's why when I went slower, I saw more deeply. And when I actually stopped, all my senses had all the time in the world for the images to fully form, and for my hearing to fully hear, and for my mind to fully know what I was experiencing. I had the time. I'm not sure if any of you have developed your own photographs. This is in the age before digital cameras. I remember at a university, just in a science class, doing some developing in the dark room. And as you actually put that photographic plate in there, and as it starts to develop with the chemicals, you can see the image appearing slowly, 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 as it becomes more rich in colour, more detailed. It's a slow process as it forms the image. That's what happens in your mind as well. If you stop it too quickly, you don't get the full image with all its brightness. That's what was happening to me when I was looking through the window of a car. Things were going so fast that I could never truly see the details of what was going on. Those of you who live in some apartment or some house somewhere, you may think you know the street in which you live. If you've always been going in a car, in a vehicle, from your garage, down the road and back again in the evening, I challenge you, try walking along that road one day, and you'll know what I knew then. You'll see many, many different things. You may have been going up and down that street in your car for years. When you walk, it will look different. Now you can understand why we meditate to slow the mind down, first of all. Because if too many things are happening in the mind, if your mind is going too fast, what you see is actually not the full picture. You assume that you know what's going on, but because the images are changing so rapidly, you only get a fraction of the information before you have to go on to the next thing. Now, unfortunately, that's most people's lives. We rush around so much, we always have so many things to do, that we never fully appreciate even one thing. For those of you who have stomachache or digestion problems, this is how you overcome bad digestion. You eat more slowly. And I say that because what happens when you're eating, when you put some food in the mouth, the whole point of putting it in your mouth and having nice tastes is that once it tastes good, then all the saliva starts to come out of your mouth. All of the bile and other juices come out of the digestive tract to fully digest it. It has to be delicious, it has to taste nice for those juices to be stimulated to come out. If it doesn't taste nice, the juices just don't come out. Just to show you what I mean, think now of your favorite food. Just think of it now, just the one you really, really like. You can see the saliva start to come out. And that does not work for food you don't like. So the point is that appreciating and tasting your food fully will actually get all those juices coming out. Now if, you know, you're eating, you're talking to somebody, or you're eating really quickly because you've got to come back for this, you know, session this afternoon or whatever else you're doing. If you're eating very quickly, because you're not being mindful of the taste, you don't fully know them, those juices don't get secreted. So the food goes into your stomach, there's not enough juice to digest your food. So you have a bad digestion, you don't get the main benefit from the food, you get sick and weak because you're not fully digesting what you're eating. It's important to do things slowly so you can fully know, you can fully appreciate these things. Now if that's what happens with like eating, imagine what it's like with living life. I don't know how old each one of you are, how many years you've lived, but how much of life do you really know? Or have you been going so fast, like my simile of myself going in a car for 10 years, thinking, assuming I knew where I was going, I knew my surroundings, and being shocked to find how little I knew, because I was always going so fast. Strange thing happens when you slow down your mind. Instead of going from one thing to another, you slow down and stop. And when you start to stop your mind, you tend to see much more. Here's a simile for you. I do many similes with cups. You haven't heard this one for many years now. I don't think I did this at the Champaka retreat, so this is a new one for you. I hold up a cup and I'm over the top here. And I ask you, what is this? What is it? Anyone got any idea what this is? Yeah, what else is it? Yeah, anything else? Vesa, anything else? What else can you see here? Hand, yeah, the design, anything else? Nothing, I've already making a point here. The longer you look, the more you see. When I first held this up and said, what is it? You said cup. Is that all it was? It's much more than that. But a lot of times we look at it quickly, we say it's a cup, we think we've finished our task, and we go on to something else. And that's why we never really understand what this is, cup. The person you're married to, who are they? Sometimes we think we know them. And you know in a marriage, in a relationship, if you really think you know your partner, that relationship is dead. Much of a relationship is always discovering new things about the person you're living with. That's what keeps the relationship alive. Discovery. A lot of times, we actually close our minds off to new things because we're not still enough to see. So, the next time you see your husband or your wife, just as if like holding up, who is this? Don't think you know, because if you think you know, you'll stop looking. Hold it up, and amazing what you might find in them. Because you're not going fast, you see more details. You see more of the person you live with. You see more of a cup. You see more of life. What is life? We go so fast, we don't really understand what it is. That's why people can be 60, 70, 80, 90 years of age, and they still don't understand the meaning of life, what it is. That's why 60, 70, 80 years of age, they still have to come to the Buddhist temple and listen to talks by people like me. I kept telling people, my job as a teacher is to get rid of you. My job is actually to get rid of all my disciples. It's actually to get you so wise, so enlightened, you don't need to come to the BGF ever again. And I must be a terrible teacher, because some of you keep coming back every time. Imagine if I was a school teacher, and I was teaching, say, grade 6, and they kept on coming back year after year after year after year. I'd be a terrible teacher. But if we slow down, we can see more. And there's another aspect of slowing down which I'd like to emphasize here. Because when I slowed down and stopped, it wasn't just that the hillside had more details in it. It wasn't just I saw more, but what I saw appeared more beautiful. And that actually was quite strange. But when I contemplated it and found out what that meant, I understood a lot about Buddhist meditation and the path to enlightenment. The slower you go, it's not that you get more insight, but you also get more happiness. Just as when I was going slowly, the colors had more chance to register in my retina. When I stopped, the colors fully formed, the detail formed. And nature is beautiful. It's suffering only when we go so fast and we don't appreciate what we're experiencing. But when you start going slow, happiness comes in your mind. And the hillside looks incredibly beautiful. It's the same that when I was a young monk. Sometimes you had a lot of suffering as a young monk. And I remember when, again, Ajahn Sumedho, he told his story, he was having a particular difficult time over a few days, and Ajahn Chah came up to him, saw he was suffering, and asked him this question. He said, is my monastery suffering, or are you suffering? Where does that suffering lie? Is it within the monastery, or is it within you? And of course, it was a very good question, because it was obvious that the suffering was not in his monastery. If it was, then you'd be suffering all the time. You'd never have any happiness at all. The suffering was in him. That's where the problem lied. The fact that we don't have happiness, is not suffering is not part of samsara, in the sense suffering is out there. Suffering is in here, is in you. It's not the monastery is suffering. It's not the world is suffering. You are suffering. And that's a very powerful point which Ajahn Chah made. Because if the world was suffering, there would be no escape from suffering. But if the suffering was in you, you can do something about it. And this is what happens when you go slow and you start to see the world. The world actually looks much more happy and more beautiful. When you see much more with insight, the problem of pain and suffering starts to disappear. When I walked slowly up that hillside, when I stood still, the hillside looked very, very beautiful. When I was going fast, it looked dull and boring and depressing. Now you can understand a little bit about your state of happiness and suffering in life. Why is it that people have so much depression and suffering? It's because they're moving too fast, that's why. Why is it that depression is a modern phenomena? There's many, many more people are getting depressed and angry these days than before, because we are working so hard, we're running so fast. That's the reason why. Which is why just slowing down a little bit, taking it easy, not rushing around so much, you find that you get greater happiness, more energy, and you see more in life. The very first meditation retreat which I went on was actually organized by our Cambridge Buddhist Society many, many years ago. And I, you know, volunteered to go on that one. I paid my money and In those days there was no retreat centres at all, not even Christian ones. So we hired a boarding house, about 3 boarding houses, and had people staying in all the rooms. This was vacation time, so the boarding houses, usually filled with students, were empty. And we meditated there. A strange thing happened was that in Cambridge, in the university, the boarding house food was notorious for being just so unappetizing. It was usually things like mashed potatoes and just vegetables which had been boiled so much they didn't taste of anything at all. And you know, the boarding house people were, they didn't have much money to spend on nice sauces, and they didn't have much expertise on cookery. They weren't chefs, and the food was just so awful. And it was notorious for that. But when we went on this retreat, when it came to the lunchtime, the food was delicious. I mean, it really tasted nice. And at first I thought, my goodness, we must have struck lucky. We must have got the best boarding house chef in the whole of Cambridge. That the food was just so tasty. And I thought the happiness was with the chef. Was in the food. It was only later when I became a monk I realized, no, it was nothing to do with the cooks. It was to do with the one who was tasting the food. Because I was going slower, because my mind had slowed down, just like slowing down walking up that hill, I could appreciate the taste of the food more. I could actually receive more of the tastes when I was eating it. And you may have had that experience yourself. Whenever you've gone on to a retreat, a time of quiet, the food which you eat will always be exceptionally delicious. And it's nothing to do with the cooks. It's to do with your mind. You've started going slower. So all of you who like nice food, you should come on a retreat. You should meditate. If you're going out one night, if your boyfriend, your girl, your husband or your wife, if they're going to take you out to a beautiful 5-star restaurant, and they're going to pay all this money to cooks, great chefs, who are the best chef in the whole of Kuala Lumpur, and that restaurant has been written about in the social pages, and the who's who of society goes there, then if you really want to get your money's worth, half an hour beforehand, meditate. So when you go in there, your mind is just so slow and so clear. You can taste every part of that delicious meal. The point of the story is that the more slow you go, the stronger your mindfulness, the more information your senses receive, life becomes more rich and more beautiful and more happy. That's one of the reasons why meditating monks are happy. We experience the same world as other people. The same data comes into our consciousness. We're going much slower, that we can appreciate much more. You literally see much more. Which is another reason why you can be so forgiving and compassionate to others. When you're running around going fast and you see someone, you can't truly understand who's standing before you. You can't see them deeply enough. But when you're going slowly, even just this awful prisoner like I was talking this morning, because you're going slowly, you can see much more inside of them. You can even see their beauty. Because your mind is still, you can appreciate even criminals much more. You can see their beauty, and they know you can see it. Life becomes more beautiful and happy the slower you go. So that's the second part about meditation. It's not that you see more, but you become happier, you become brighter people. So when we say like transforming the mind, you're transforming not just insight, but also happiness. You get two. It's like the free gift which comes along with insight. It's part of the same package. You get happiness as well as deep seeing. And this is actually how we transform our minds. As you practice this slowing down your mind, letting go of all this wanting this and wanting that, so you become more peaceful, more still. Your mind goes slower. You become happier, you have more insight, you see things more deeply. And it even means that your relationships become much more rich and meaningful. You're becoming more sensitive to the person you're living with. You're literally seeing much more, and you're appreciating them much more. It's always the case when people come to do some meditation with me. I told this story last Friday night in Perth, and someone came up to me afterwards laughing and say, "That happened to me today." Because what the story is that sometimes people want to come to meditation, but they've been working so hard and they're tired, they've got so much to do, there's a good movie on the TV tonight. And their children says, "Mummy, you must go to meditation." "I don't feel like going." "You must go, Mummy." "Why should I go?" "Because, Mummy, you're so grumpy when you don't go to meditation." And I told that story last Friday in Perth. Afterwards, this lady came and said, she was laughing all over her face, "I didn't want to come this evening. My 7-year-old daughter sent me." And she said, "If I don't come to meditation, I'm just so grumpy and tell her off." The children know that with meditation become more sensitive, more happy, more kind. So, if you've got a grumpy husband, send him to the next meditation retreat. That's in Cameron Highlands in June. Give him some money, say go. And if he says, "I don't want to go," go! "Why should I go?" "Because, husband, you're such a grumpy husband, but if you go on a retreat, you'll be so nice." And it's true, it works. Because what's happening, because you're slowing down, you're appreciating life more, you get more happiness, you get more insights. One of the first insights which I got when I was a meditator was what I was talking about this morning, about seeing the benefit of virtue. When my mind was still, you could see, why did I want to hurt anybody? I became so sensitive when you were meditating, you just could not hurt anybody. You know, how can I hurt my friends, even my enemies? I don't want to make them unhappy. What do I want to do that for? And all those precepts. I didn't, as I mentioned this morning about alcohol, I didn't understand why. I didn't even know it was a precept. All those precepts of stealing and lying. The time I found out when there were 5 precepts was this. I'd been meditating a while, and I was visiting the Thai temple. It was in Isheen at that time. It's now moved to Wimbledon in the southwest of London. It was my closest temple, so I went there. And I'd be going to listen to Dharma talks and meditating. And one day, one of the Thai monks came up to me. He could speak reasonably good English. And he said, "I've seen you. You've been coming to this temple long enough. It's about time you took the 5 precepts." That's what he said. And so I said, "Venerable, what are these 5 precepts?" He said, "Oh, you know, not deliberately killing a living being, not stealing, not committing adultery, not lying, not taking alcohol and drugs." Now, I didn't mean to be cheeky, but what I actually said is, "Venerable sir, I don't need to take those precepts, because I've been keeping them for the last year. What do I need to do a ceremony for?" And I'd actually discovered those precepts for myself. No one taught me them. I saw them because I was becoming sensitive in my meditation. It didn't make any sense to me to lie, to steal, or to take alcohol or drugs. Why do that? I had enough happiness without it. So the meditation was giving me an insight, a wisdom into why we should keep precepts, why we should be compassionate. I even became a vegetarian as well. No one told me to. It's just I became sensitive and think, I don't need to eat the flesh of animals. Why do I want to do that for? It just became natural. I wasn't doing it as some sort of penance. I wasn't trying to be some goody-goody, you know, the best Buddhist in the whole of Cambridge. That wasn't my point. It just, I felt like this was the natural thing to do. What it taught me is when you purify your mind, when the mind becomes still, when you transform your mind, the whole of the rest of your life starts to transform as well. It's not just precepts, it's also compassion starts to arrive from a still mind. as Buddhists, we're supposed to be compassionate. And it's true that people do go to the temples and they release animals. And then when they go home, even before they get home, they shout at the car which cuts in front of them. They can be they can be compassionate to the animals in the temple, but they're not compassionate to other drivers. Or when they get home, they're certainly not compassionate to their husband. Now, what's going on here is because it's only a forced compassion. We're compassionate because we think we should be compassionate, that's all. And it just becomes some game which we play. It hasn't not really coming from the heart. And I've always found that once you are meditating, you become still, you become so sensitive to other beings, the compassion becomes a natural response. You're kind because there's no other choice. Some years ago I went to give a talk, actually it was the top school in Perth, I think it came top of the tables this year as well, St Hilda's, an Anglican girls' school. And I gave a talk about Buddhism, and afterwards the principal, the headmistress, invited me for tea afterwards. We had this really interesting discussion. Now she was saying, because she was an Anglican, she was saying compassion, love always came from God. And I said, no, compassion, love comes from emptiness, from stillness. We had this amazing discussion. We should have recorded it, because she couldn't really consider how can compassion come from peace, from emptiness. And that has always been my experience. Now, from a God, sometimes it's not compassion at all, but it's punishment, a fearful God. But from stillness and peace, if you find any peace or stillness in your heart, you'll always find compassion flows effortlessly from that. The two can always go together. If you really think about it, when you're really still and peaceful, that you yourself are satisfied, you're fulfilled, you're at ease, your own needs are gone in peacefulness. So you're fully at the service of others. When you're really at peace and got inner stillness yourself, then you are free to care. It's one of the problems of being a monk. Sometimes when I'm let go of all my duties and I just sit there being peaceful, people think, oh, he's free. I can go and ask him a question now. But if I was always busy, I was always reading something or writing something down, when I was sitting up the top there, if I was doing something all the time, I'd think, oh, I better not disturb him, he's doing something. But because I'm a monk who knows how to be peaceful, sometimes I'll just sit there being peaceful. So people think, oh, he's free, and they come and bother me. But the point is that I don't mind that, because if you're still, if you're free, you are available for others. If you're busy, then you can't have time for other people. Do you understand why compassion always comes from stillness, from peace? That's why that if you can grant yourself a few moments of peace, you'll find you're a far more compassionate person. So when you train the mind in stillness and peace, not only do you get insight, not only do you get happiness, you also get heaps and heaps of compassion. And the greatest compassionate people I've seen in my life are not the scholars, not the ones who've read all the books. It's not the ones who know everything. It's the ones who can be still and make their minds calm and peaceful. I always remember the first time my mind really got into deep states of calmness. And it was just such a wonderful experience, so much happiness. I just wanted to get to my teacher and just kiss his feet all over. That's actually how I felt. Such gratitude and such love for someone who showed you how to be peaceful. It's the greatest gift of all. We say the greatest gift is the gift of the Dhamma, but it doesn't mean the words or the ideas. It means the peace and the happiness which come from that Dhamma. It's not pitying the books. It's actually seeing what the message in those books are and internalizing it. And if ever you get that degree of peace and inner happiness, you want to kiss my feet. I'll tell you that will happen to you. But please don't, it's against my rules, and you might catch some disease. But you get such happiness, it just transforms into compassion. You want to help the whole world. And you've got the energy and the wisdom to do so. So when you start transforming your mind in peace, just by being still, then compassion flows. as actually to how to meditate. Oh, there's so many different teachings about meditation, but look, there's such a simple, easy thing to do. We make it complicated. All you need to do is sit there and do nothing. That's all you need. But what do? They always want to do meditation. They're doing this method or doing that method. How do you meditate? I do anapanasati, I do vipassana, I do metta, I do this. And so if you try that, you'll never get anywhere with meditation. Just stop doing things. Just sit there and do nothing. Just see what happens, that's all. That's one of my favourite sayings. Those of you who know me, say, I'll see what happens. I don't worry about the future. I don't even worry about what I'm going to say next. I just see what happens. Just let it all flow. This is how you meditate. You stop doing things and allow things to be. There are two types of meditation. Those of you who heard me say this before, be quiet. What are those two types of meditation? Anyone know? Sometimes people say samatha and vipassana. And I say, no, that is wrong. The two types of meditation on a much deeper level are Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. You may not have heard that before if you haven't heard me speak. I'm the only monk who speaks like this. This is unique, Ajahn Brahm. I got the patent on this teaching. Not having anyone can say this. But if those of you who know classic Buddhism, the second noble truth is the cause of suffering, called craving. So what do I mean by second noble truth meditation? It means craving, craving, craving. I want to become enlightened. I want to get into jhana. I want to be peaceful. I want to be happy. I want to do this. I want to do that. I want to meditate the longest. I want to beat my record. 40 minutes, I'm going to do it an hour. I'm going to become enlightened. That's craving. Wanting. Now, so many people do Second Noble Truth Meditation. They want, they crave, they want to be peaceful, they want to be enlightened, they want to solve all their problems. Sometimes people meditate because they want to get psychic powers. This is the first time I went to teach meditation in jail. This was in Canning Vale Jail. It was the top security jail in Perth. It had about 115 prisoners. About 108 of them or something came to my class. I got about 90%, over 90% of the population came to learn meditation. When I saw that, I never expected that prisoners would be so interested in developing their mind. I was so impressed and inspired, I thought, if these guys want to come to my meditation class, I'm going to walk the extra mile for them. I'm going to really teach them some really good meditation. If people are that in a prison, if they're that interested, I'm going to really give it everything I've got. I'm going to meet them halfway. So I started talking, trying to inspire them, and really doing my best, extra, because of their response. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, one of the prisoners, he later became a great friend of mine, and he's one of the tough guys in the jail. He put his hand up. He said, "Can I ask a question?" And I looked at this guy, he was big, a huge fellow, and very mean. And when someone big and mean says, "Can I ask a question?" you always say, "Yes, yes." So I said, "Yes, what's your question?" And he said, is it true that through meditation you can learn to fly through the air, to levitate? And then I suddenly realized why so many prisoners have come to my class. They were coming to learn meditation, not to do anything with their lives, not to transform their mind and transform their action and become good guys. The only reason they came to the class was to learn how to fly through the air and escape over the walls. And of course, I said, it takes many, 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 many years to do things like that. And only a few people can manage it. And if they do, they never tell anybody. You know why we don't tell anybody if we get psychic powers? If you could levitate, then the Malaysian Athletics Association will make sure you go into the Olympics in Beijing to compete in the high jump and the pole vault. If you could read people's minds, and the government knew that, the CIA will get you and make sure you go to Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay to see what those prisoners are really thinking. And if they don't do that, they'll put you at the security gate of KLIA so that you'll be the one who finds out who's a terrorist. You can just read their mind as they go through. He's okay, he's okay, he's carrying a bomb, he's okay. No, she's she's got a knife in her purse, she's got extra alcohol in her bags. It'd be much better than the security systems they got so far. So which is the reason why we don't actually tell about psychic powers if we've got one and get into big trouble. But this is actually one reason why some people try and meditate, because they're trying to get something out of it. They're craving. It's called Second Noble Truth Meditation. If there's craving there, if there's wanting, what did the Buddha say in the Second Noble Truth? Craving leads to suffering. So no wonder you suffer and it doesn't work. You say, oh, meditation is so hard. I can't get my mind peaceful. I can't do this, I can't do that. People were complaining about samadhi headache. They were meditating and getting headaches and getting stressed. I think, what are you doing? That's Second Noble Truth Meditation. Craving, you've got suffering. So if the meditation isn't working, if you're getting suffering, you have to be doing some craving somewhere. You're not meditating properly. It's not meditation's fault. It's not your fault. It's not that you can't do this. It's you're not following the instructions. You're doing it wrong. That's why it's not working. So the other type of meditation is called Third Noble Truth Meditation. Where the Buddha said, letting go of craving leads to nibbana, the end of suffering. It leads to peace, to happiness. Nibbana is the highest happiness. Nibbana is ultimate peace. It's stillness, it's joy, it's happiness. So if that's what you want for meditation, that's what meditation is supposed to be doing, transforming the heart, transforming the mind, then make sure you're doing it the proper way. Letting go. Freeing the mind. Letting go. First, there's four types of letting go, the Buddha said. This is a very deep teaching. I've given this on the retreat, but I'm going to give it again now because it's a powerful teaching. And it's, I don't know why other people don't teach this, because it's straight from the sutta, straight from the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. The Third Noble Truth is letting go of craving. In other words, chaga patinissaga muti analaya. There's four ways of letting go. The first way of letting go is called chaga. It means giving, generosity. Now what does that have to do with letting go? If it really is generosity, it's giving, expecting nothing back in return. If you give a donation to my retreat center, but you want your name put on the board there somewhere, Mrs. Tan, 100 ringgit. That is not giving, that is business. If you want your name read out, no, Mrs. Chan, 1,000 ringgit, and everyone claps, that is business again. But if it's giving, expecting nothing back in return, you know, put the envelope in the Buddhist Gem Fellowship for the BTF expenses. No one knows you've done that. You're giving, expecting nothing back in return, not even a receipt. That is true giving. That's why it's called letting go. So when we meditate, can you meditate expecting nothing back in return? Not expecting to be peaceful. Not expecting to be still. Not expecting enlightenment. If you can do that, happiness, stillness, enlightenment come. It only happens when you don't expect. Because if you're expecting, you cannot be inspecting. There's the two differences. expectation and inspectation. Inspectation is insight, looking within. Expectation is looking outside there someone. That's why it doesn't work. It's like, you know what the opposite for insight is? Excite. So you get excited. And that's not insight. So here, when we give expecting nothing back in return, you meditate, you don't expect to get peace, you don't expect to get still, you don't want anything. Then it's Third Noble Truth meditation. Then it really is letting go. The patting this to go is like relinquishing, throwing things away, not trying to accumulate things. My teacher Ajahn Chah used to say, you meditate not to get something, but to get rid of something. Not even to get somewhere, but to be more fully where you really are now. You're not trying to get anywhere else, you're trying to be more fully here. You're meditating to let go of all this getting somewhere, going somewhere. It's more like being here. You're meditating not to achieve, but just to be here. The third type of letting go is called freedom. And of course, freedom is, what do we actually mean by freedom? And I got the meaning of that word freedom, again another prison story which we've heard before, but it's a great story. This was when I became the abbot, so one of the other monks had to go and talk in jail. And when they were talking in jail one day, after the talk they asked him what my monastery is like. What do you do as a monk, they said. We get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. 4 o'clock in the morning, even in jail you don't get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. 6 at the earliest, usually only 7. But then what do? Can you watch the news on TV? No, there is no TV. The radio? No radio. Any CDs? Any music? No. You have to meditate. And very often there's no breakfast. If there is a breakfast, just a very small breakfast, they don't even give you a choice. Then what do? We have to work really hard. Mixing concrete, laying bricks. We're labourers, even I do that. They say, well, they never get us to do that in jail. Not in Australia, anyway. And then we have our one meal of the day. We eat out of our bowl in Perth. Those of you who've been there have seen us. Sometimes the custard goes on the spaghetti. Sometimes the ice cream melts all over the curry. What are you saying that for? Have you ever had ice cream and curry? It's actually very delicious. Especially chocolate ice cream on green curry. Try it and see. And they said, that's disgusting, said the prisoners. Even in prison they give you separate, parts of your plate or your tray to have your food on. Then what do? Is there any sex? No sex in the monastery. Sport? Can you play soccer in the afternoon? No soccer either. You just have to meditate all afternoon. Wow, that's a bit tough. What about in the evening? Can you have dinner? No, there's no dinner. Even in jail they give you a dinner in the evening. No, it's just more meditation right into it. And at night you sleep on the floor. Wow, even in jail they give you cots to sleep on. And he went on like this. And the prisoner said, that's terrible in your monastery. That's awful in your monastery. And one of the prisoners, forgetting where they were, said, that's terrible. Why don't you come in here and stay with us? And the point of that story was, it is a fact that prisons are very often more comfortable than monasteries. So why is it that people in a prison want to escape? Well, people in a monastery, in monasteries such as mine, as you know, there is always, for the last I don't know how many years, a waiting list of people trying to join. And it's obvious, when I thought about that, I got my understanding of what freedom means. Freedom is the opposite of a prison. And a prison is any place you do not want to be. Any place. Now this is a powerful teaching, this is why I don't mind repeating it. If you are in a relationship which you don't like, you'll find your partnership, your marriage is like a prison for you. You don't want to be there. It feels like a prison. If you're in a job you hate, then it becomes a prison again. If you're in a body which is sick and hurting, you just don't want it, your body becomes a prison. And if you're in the BGF on a Tuesday afternoon and you can't wait for this talk to finish, if you don't want to be here, you're in a prison again. And the point is, how do you escape from a prison? The point is, it does not matter how uncomfortable or how harsh it is. The comfort or the harshness do not make a prison. It's only whether you want to be here or not. That's what makes a prison. So if you change your attitude to the one you live with, instead of not wanting to be here, wanting to be here, let's want to make use of this. This is my learning experience. I want this man, this woman around me, because I may be having a difficult time, but I want this, because I'm going to learn from this. I'm going to make it work. I want it to be. Then you are free. It's no longer a prison because you want to be there. If you're in a job and you change your attitude to see the benefits of that job, you want to be there. It's not, it doesn't feel like a prison anymore. If you're in a body, a sick or an old body, but you come to peace with that body, you want to be here. Your body does not feel like a prison. And with whatever mental state you may be experiencing in your meditation, instead of saying, I don't want to be dull, I don't want to have a restless mind, I don't want to be thinking all these silly thoughts, if you change and say, I want to be here. This is okay, having a dull mind, having a restless mind. Then you feel free. And the strange thing in meditation, if you understand what I'm talking about there and put it into practice, if you are at peace with your mind, then your mind becomes peace. The restless thoughts just fade away. The dullness finishes. The mind becomes peaceful. Not because you've made it peaceful, but because you have got out of the way and let it be peaceful. That's how to be free. I've done that many times. The story I told in Chimpaka Lodge was a story from my 6th year as a monk. I was in a monastery in the north of Thailand, alone in this monastery for the 3 months of the rainy season retreat. It was a perfect monastery. The temperature was really beautiful, great food, and the lay community didn't bother me at all. All they wanted to do was to feed me and let me get on with my meditation. It was idyllic, except for my mind. Because after the inspiration of the first couple of weeks, my mind started to become restless. And I tried to stop my restless mind by focusing on the breath. The more I tried, the more my mind started to wander. And when it started to wander, it started to wander into what I call unmonkish thoughts. And of course, I was very embarrassed about that. So I tried even harder to control my mind. But it got worse and worse and worse. And I never had any other monk to talk to. I was on my own. And it got to such a terrible stage. I don't mind telling you this, but I was thinking of girls, sexual fantasies, the whole works. I'd go off onto this fantasy and I'd try and pull my mind back onto the breath. It would go off again. I was going crazy. So, you know, if I hadn't got a bit of insight, I may not have been Ajahn Brahmana. I might be, you know, the husband of somebody else or something. I don't know. But I had a bit of, at least an insight. I went to the main hall. I bowed to the Buddha statue there. And I just asked for help, basically. It was out of desperation. And the idea which came into my mind was this. I said, I'll do a deal with my mind. If you want to think those sorts of thoughts, you know, really unmonkish, romance, sex or whatever, you can do that for 1 hour of the day. The rest of the day, you behave yourself and you watch the breath. I thought that, you know, if I gave my mind a little bit of, you know, freedom to do what it wants, then maybe the rest of the day it will comply. That was a deal I did. From 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. every day, You can sit in your heart, you can think whatever you like, I'm not going to stop you, I'm not going to be embarrassed, you can go for your life. So, having made that deal, I sat down and tried to watch the breath. It did not work. My mind was just still as wanton, as rebellious as ever. You'd watch the breath and you start thinking of an old girlfriend. Come back. You go watch the breath again, you start thinking of something else. Come back. And it was a struggle. And when you're struggling like that, it's so much pain and you get so tired, you get so frustrated. But I kept on going. But soon it came to 3 p.m. And at least, like I'm a monk, if I make a promise, I keep it. And so it came to 3 p.m. I said, okay, now I've got to keep the other part of the bargain. I went up to my hut. I leant against the wall of the hut because, you know, it's very tiring sitting all day. I put my feet out. And I said, right, mind, whatever you want to think about, I'm not going to try and stop you now. You can think anything you like, sex, romance, the weirdest of fantasies, go for it. And for the next hour, my mind was so peaceful, just watching the breath without a break all out. That's what happened. And I learned a great skill and truth of meditation. I realized why my mind was actually creating all those fantasies and dreams, why it was being so rebellious. Because I was trying to control it. That's why. I was doing second noble truth meditation. Wanting, controlling, craving. And this was the result. When I did letting go, if you want to be a sexual fantasy, that's okay with me. Freedom. The door of my heart's open to your mind, no matter what you ever do. And the point is that when you say things like that, you give it full freedom. It doesn't just go crazy. It goes peaceful. And when it became peaceful, I realized the third way of letting go. Freedom. Giving my mind freedom. The door of my heart's open. I'm not going to scold you. I'm not going to praise you. Mind, whatever you want to do, it's all right with me. I'm just going to watch. I'm just going to be peaceful. I'm happy to be here. No matter what. Just sitting here, that's good enough for me. If you're peaceful, you get into jhana, you go crazy, it's okay. When I gave it that freedom, I gave it peace. It showed me peace. And my mind became so still. And I learned an important trick in meditation. How to let go. Now you can meditate any old time. You start with crazy minds, tired minds, still minds. And I never try and control it. I just watch it with peace. Mind, the door of my heart's open to you, no matter who you are, no matter what you do. Unconditional acceptance. I just watch it like that. In a few minutes, my mind is just so still and peaceful and bright. That's how to meditate. Not second noble truth, third noble truth meditation. And the last of the ways of letting go, analia, is actually not having any place where things can actually settle and grow. What I call having a Teflon mind. So things of the past, they don't stick to you. It comes and it goes and that's it. You know that Teflon surface, you know, they put that on the frying pans and it means that you don't have to wash them, everything just falls off. It's like a lotus, you know, the water can go in it but the water doesn't stick. Experiences come into your mind and nothing sticks. That's the other way of letting go. So you have an experience and you never keep it. You never amass anything in this world. You're always empty. I use that as, why Ajahn Chah used that as his way of teaching counselors. He said if you're a counselor, if you're teaching others, if they're telling you their problems, as they do to me, as they do to many of you, he said, you are like a dustbin. People will come and dump all their problems on you. All the rubbish and pain and suffering of their life, they'll pour out into you. As a counselor, you have to be a big dustbin, because sometimes people have a lot of problems. But he said, always remember, when you're a counselor, to be a dustbin, but to be a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. So when they pour things in, you keep nothing. He just goes right through you and out the other end. And that way, that when they leave, your dustbin is empty to receive the rubbish of the next person coming in. And after you've done all your counselling, you go home. Your dustbin is empty for your husband to pour all his...
you never keep anything. I know it's just a wise teaching of a monk who never had any training in university or any counseling courses. I know what a wonderful thing that was. And that's actually in life as well. Never keep anything. When you never keep anything, you're always free and open for the next experience. Someone can give you a very difficult time, have a very hard time in the office, but you don't keep it. You leave it at the office, so you don't take it home to worry your partner with or worry your children with. You have a mind which can let go, which doesn't keep anything. If you really want to keep things, keep the nice stuff, the happy things which happen. When you go home and say, oh, a wonderful thing happened in the office today. How many of you, when you go home, tell you about the rotten things which happened on the way home? Those are the things you shouldn't keep. You should throw in the dustbin. But tell your partner all the wonderful things which happened to you today, not the rotten things. And tell yourself all the nice things which happened to you in your life. Never keep the rotten things. They're the ones which should be thrown away. The best actually is to throw the whole lot away. Then you can be open to whatever happens. So those are the ways of letting go. Now understand those are the ways of meditating. Now you can understand, should we focus on the breath? Should we focus on loving? Should we do insight? Do we do this? Do that? It doesn't matter what your object is, it's how you do the meditation that's important. If you follow that way and doing giving, expecting nothing back in return, sort of this idea of like freeing the mind, being content, being just happy to be here. Don't matter about what you're experiencing, just be content with it. Like, you know, throwing away the past, throwing away the future, and being like a mind which doesn't keep anything at all. Then you know how to meditate, you know how to transform your heart. And it becomes so peaceful, so still. In that peacefulness and stillness, you will find happiness. You don't need to look for it, because it's right there, in this moment. And you're such a happy person. And it's a happiness which doesn't need anything, it's just there. And you're someone, because of the happiness and stillness, you can really see deeply into things. You can see deeply into the people you meet during the day. You're sensitive to them and can really be compassionate to them. And you're sensitive to the people you live with. You're sensitive to life. And you're sensitive to yourself. So you can be just one happy little Buddhist. One wise Buddhist. You have transformed your heart. So there goes the talk. Now come the questions. So, okay, I got a question from the back straight away. Any questions at the top? Please write them down up in the heaven realms above. Yes. Yeah. Actually, it's the same as the difference between Ajahn Brahma Wangso and Ajahn Brahm. It's actually the same. Yeah. So there's the heart and the mind. I use them interchangeably. Okay, you've got a question here. What is the karmic effect of having a big ego and keep harnessing it in life? Big ego means big suffering. It is true. You can actually find that out. Sort of little ego means little suffering. No ego means no suffering. That's right, yeah. But I still think this is Singapore. So it's something about the ego. And my answer was, ego, she go, we all go. So what's the point of having a sense of self? We all have to go anyway. Go on, yes.
How do you equate, can you tell us more, how do you equate the learning for meditation equals to learning to die?
Oh, that's right, yeah. Okay, yeah, sure. It's actually learning how to die and meditation. I think already I mentioned with having no expectations, no wants, being content. And this is very important, that when you're dying, to be content with your sick body, with your old body, with your dying body. Because sometimes people haven't got that contentment, and they struggle
They struggle to live. They're not content with the dying process. They don't make peace with their death. And when people do that, they struggle to the very, very end. I've seen people do that. They're struggling for life. They're afraid of death. And they struggle, and their death is just so painful. And they're struggling against forces which they cannot conquer. They're dying and they can't stop it, but they try to. There's again big ego trying to control the process and thinking that they can stop death. So if we can learn how to just to accept things and be at peace with things and let go in this life while we still have health, then when we come to that time we know how to let go and abandon this control and be content with the dying process. To be free, not to have our possessions and our loved ones stick to us. There's always many more loved ones coming in your next life. So you can let go of the old ones and get some new ones. Variety is the spice of life, they say. So when we think about that, we can learn how to let go. And this is what dying is. You're letting go of your family, your loved ones, your attachments, your body, and even your mind states. And the more you learn how to let go in meditation, the easier it is to let go when you're dying. You've been practicing, abandoning, letting go, putting things down. But in a deeper way, when you actually learn very deep meditation, I'm talking about the jhanas which I teach now, as you go into this meditation of letting go more and more and more, just by this no expecting, stillness, contentment, what actually happens is the external things disappear as you go more inwards inside yourself. And there's like stages of letting go which happen. These actually aren't always things which you do, there's just things which happen. You don't make these stages occur. This is just what happens on the journey inside. And the first thing which usually disappears is your perception of past and future. You come into a present moment awareness. All past and all future disappear, and that becomes like timelessness. You let go of the concept of time. And then the next thing which usually disappears in meditation is your thinking, all these words, all these naming. So you're aware without giving things labels. You go more deeper into the silence of the mind. And the next stage of letting go which happens is you let go of diversity to unity. You pick up one thing in the mind, which can be loving kindness, it can be the breath, it can be just that one thing which you focus on. And as you're focusing on the breath more and more and more, you notice that you don't hear things, you don't feel your body, that actually the bodily sensations disappear. All you've got left is the breath, and you don't know anything else which is happening around you. You can't feel your feet, you can't feel your hands, your body literally disappears from your consciousness. You've let go of your body. And as you go deeper, the breath disappears, and that's actually you've let go of, at that point, the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. And in its place comes what we call this beautiful light, the nimitta, the samadhi nimitta it's called, this beautiful light which appears in the mind when the breath disappears. And that is a reflection of the mind, the sixth sense in Buddhism. Now it's at this stage when you can get familiarity with what we call the nimitta, this light in the mind, when the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching disappear. You get a great training in dying. Because those of you who have read about people who have had out-of-the-body experiences, or who have had those experiences themselves, you know what happens when you die. When you die, your body disappears and your five physical senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching turn off. They're not active anymore. And once they're not active anymore, you sense floating out of your body and going towards the light. That light which you can see in meditation when your five senses disappear is exactly the same as the light you see when you die. So, when you get to the nimitta stages of meditation, you see the light which appears when the five physical senses turn off. You're experiencing exactly what happens when you die. You're training. Doing research into what death's all about. In meditation, you're letting go of the body, letting go of the five senses, temporarily. And you go into these deep states of bliss, where you can't feel the body, you don't know what's going on in the body, you're very, very safe. You're in the jhanas. In death, it's permanent. In the jhanas, it's only just for a short time. That's why people in those deep states of meditation, sometimes people think they're dead.